I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I'm not sure why it is that we find ourselves enthralled with stories about those fateful moments in history on which everything else seems to hinge. But we do that a lot. It's not that history does not have such moments when all could be gained or all could be lost. Sometimes it's a battle. Waterloo, the Battle of Gettysburg, the landing of Allied forces on the beaches of Normandy. Other times it's the invention of a new technology, the appearance of the printing press, or the train, or the automobile, or the A-bomb. Today we're going to hear of one such seminal moment in history, a moment during which the American Revolution could easily have been lost were it not for circumstances that neither the British nor the Americans had any control over, just like the Spanish Armada getting scattered by a terrible storm at sea. But there is an additional twist to this tale, which is the tale of Morristown, New Jersey, and the winter of 1779-80. And this twist is the story of what did not happen, but quite nearly did, the kidnapping of General George Washington. Here to draw the lines of this story more clearly is William Hazelgrove, once again with us on Constant Wonder. Hazelgrove, national best-selling author of multiple books, including Madam President, The Secret Presidency of Edith Wilson, 160 Minutes, The Race to Save the RMS Titanic, and now Morristown, The Darkest Winter of the Revolutionary War and the Plot to Kidnap George Washington. William Hazelgrove, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, you know, the story of weather without being married to the story of humans weathering the weather, that might be a little dry, you know?
Yes, yes. Weather is a big factor in a lot of watershed moments in history. And Morristown, not giving away here, in 1779, experienced once in a century bad weather, an incredible winter that was without parallel. And this created circumstances for, as you say, this incredible tale of a plot, not only a plot, because actually, you know, the book says a plot, but actually it's an expedition, because this went way beyond a plot. This was an expedition that was launched involving over 500 men to kidnap George Washington.
Yeah, most kidnappings do not involve 500 accomplices.
No, it's usually sort of this stealthy thing. We would think of SEALs or just some little force, or if you go back to even the most famous kidnapping, the Lindbergh baby, where it was one person was put to death for that. This turned into actually a military campaign, but in the Revolution, this is something probably your listeners don't know, this was regarded as standard. This type of move, think of a chessboard, to remove the king, if you will, is a quick checkmate. And so on both sides, there was plots, plans, boarded missions to try and kidnap generals, the various heads of the various divisions of the armies, and even there was a plot to kidnap Martha Washington, which George Washington was just appalled by and just thought the British were absolute scum to even entertain that. But they were going to go up the Potomac and get off a barge, run up, grab her from Mount Vernon and take her off and then hold her for ransom. So this was actually sort of looked upon as another method of waging war.
I guess this really wasn't anything new. It calls to mind stories I remember about Richard Lionheart and in the heart of Europe being held for ransom.
Exactly. You know, there were rules of engagement. You weren't supposed to kill the person you kidnapped. You were merely supposed to take them sort of off the board, if you will, and then say, okay, we've taken your king, and so give up. You know, and in this case, of course, you know, the American Revolution was an idea, really. And so the idea was sort of dependent on the zealotry, if you will, of the leaders. And George Washington was the spiritual leader, the terrestrial leader. He was a deity to a lot of these people. I mean, you know, there's no mistake that he was regarded as the father of the country. So you know, at the head of the Continental Army, if you could remove him, then, you know, the theory is with the British, who, by the way, by 1779 were so tired of this war. It was, you know, a war of attrition. It cost them all this money to have these, you know, troops all, you know, cross the ocean. And America's vast. So, you know, they were finding out the hard lesson we found out in Vietnam, that you really can't conquer a country, you know, unless you get the will of the people with you. And they certainly didn't have that. So the minute they'd leave one colony, you know, patriots would spring up behind them on the next. And so really that sort of guerrilla warfare that the Viet Cong employed and eventually forced us out in 1975, Washington used to great effect, where he could hit and run. He realized quickly from the beginning that if he had to stand and fight the British, he was in trouble. So, you know, hit and run, regroup, and this drove the British crazy because they were still doing that old model of, we see them in the movies, they all line up, one group behind the other, they all fire their muskets in unison, and then they reload, and, you know, facing their opponent. So the Americans really made them mad because we didn't play by the rules. We were like, no, we aren't going to do that gentleman's game where you fight, you know, the nice month, and in the winter you go into your winter quarters, and then you come out in the spring and fight. And then if you feel like giving up, you know, it's an elaborate ceremony. The Americans weren't that at all.
Now, you say winter quarters, and this brings to mind all of the years of the Revolution. There were winters every year, and the winter quarters, that was really a time to just kind of withdraw and sit out the season until you could re-engage?
Yeah, it really was. So it was sort of agreed upon that in the winter, both armies would go into towns. You know, like the British were in New York, and so they had a great season of theater and restaurants, and all the generals had their concubines and everything. Now, for the Americans, it wasn't such a festive time. They went into their winter quarters. Of course, a famous one is Valley Forge, which I address in the beginning of the book, which is sort of held up as the winter of, you know, the war, the winter of discontent that you know, the army almost fell apart. But, in fact, Morristown far outshines Valley Forge as a winter of suffering. Why? Because it was horrible. They had this bitter cold. It literally made them prisoners in Morristown. But the big thing was that the Hudson River froze. All right, now the Hudson River is sort of separating the British and the Americans, and the British know Washington's in Morristown with his army. And his army, by the way, is very weak. They're disintegrating. People are leaving. They're starving. And there's a lot of discontent. You know, history, we always kind of think of the Revolution, you know, everybody was all for it. Well, that wasn't the case. Most people in America had gotten very tired of this war, and they didn't want to give up money for it. They didn't want to give you tax for it. And they didn't want to give up food for it. And this really made the soldiers mad because they felt like they were doing all this suffering and they were getting no appreciation and more than that, no food. So when the Hudson freezes, all right, suddenly there's this opportunity to cross the Hudson. They know Washington's in Morristown. The British know this. And go get him. I mean, go across the Hudson with all these horses, run up to Morristown, snatch them in the middle of the night, and then take them all the way back to New York, and then bargain for terms.
So, in a way, we're talking about the weather being friendly to the British, at least at first, with the freezing of the river, because then they have an easy way to get across.
That's right. So this once in a minute, there's a guy named General Simcoe who has a vendetta, if you will, against Washington. He thinks the Americans are just rebels. He doesn't even regard them as a real fighting force. But he was captured by them and ill-treated, thrown in a jail and, you know, thrown in with common criminals. And he found this a great affront. So he actually came up with this plan. When he saw that the Hudson was freezing, he actually developed this plan with the Queen's Rangers. And what are the Queen's Rangers? This is sort of the first SEAL team. You know, they're lightning fast. They have their own carbines. They're trained to fire from the saddle. And this was Simcoe's force, General Simcoe's force. And he was like, you know, he devised a plan of just total surprise, total stealth. They would cross the Hudson at night, gallop up to, again, Washington was staying close to his army, but about 3 or 4 miles away in the Ford Mansion. he and they knew where he was sleeping, they would run in, grab him, throw him on a horse, and take him back. And this was only because of this incredible once-in-a-century freeze that allowed the Hudson to freeze solid, which it never did.
Now, you know, in history, in my observation, there really are very few moments of discrete cause and effect where one thing results in one thing. And I think that that might apply here because you talk about the topography as well, the reason George Washington was overwintering with his armies in Morristown to begin with. And well, I'm from the West, so I know what a coastal range is. I don't know New York and New Jersey, but apparently there's a low-lying mountain range there.
Yeah, the Watchung Mountains sort of were a natural barrier that Washington felt would keep the British from surprising him and coming in. He was very discontent at this time. The war had gone on a long time. He was lonely. He wasn't getting what he felt like from Congress. There had been the Conway Cabal, which was a bunch of generals and others in the American Army who felt Washington should be replaced and were trying to get rid of him. I mean, this was a time when everybody was examining whether or not this was worth it, whether or not this was going to work out. You know, the French were supposed to come in, but they hadn't done anything. And it's not coincidental that this is the time when Benedict Arnold pulled off his little treason by, basically going to the British saying, look, I'll give you the fort at West Point, and you can have control of the Hudson then. You just give me $10,000 and let me go live in Britain, and I'm good. And so, part of Morristown is this simultaneous treasonous movement by Benedict Arnold as the British are also planning to kidnap Washington. So, and the troops, Washington's own troops, will actually mutiny during this time, during this horrible winter, for food, for blankets, for, basically not getting ever paid. So really, everything is falling apart at once.
I got to have a lot of sympathy for soldiers who haven't been paid for years and who don't have food and who are suffering through the coldest winter ever. If I were tempted to say personal welfare over the welfare of the future of my country, I can see. I mean, I shouldn't say this on the air, should I? I can see myself being a traitor.
Yeah. Well, that's what, I tried to paint Benedict Arnold in this story as a very human person. Because that's what I try to do with all my books. I try to get into mythology. So everybody kind of knows Benedict Arnold, the great traitor. Well, Benedict Arnold had lost his fortune. He and his wife were on hard times. He'd given a lot. He'd given actually almost a leg to the revolution. He had this horrible limp now. At times he could barely walk. And he felt, as a lot of people did at this time, that the Americans were going to lose. That, it was not, he felt like, wow, they're going to lose. The British are going to win. I'm going to end up with nothing. Nothing. So he decided to make a deal. His wife was pushing him, saying she was this sort of very, today she'd be a very aggressive businesswoman. She was just very forceful, and she came from a wealthy family, and she was like, look, you deserve this. You deserve this. Go to the British. See what they'll pay you. If you give them secrets and give up Washington or give up a fort or something, maybe we can get something out of this. Because, they're going to lose. The Americans are going to lose anyway, and we're going to end up with nothing. So people were sort of making side bets on the revolution, saying, I don't think this is going to play out. And a lot of the populace were sort of saying, maybe it wasn't so bad being under the British at this point. This is dragged on. This is causing a lot of trouble economically. And it looks like the Americans aren't going to prevail. So when Benedict Arnold made his deal, he wasn't out of step with that thinking. And, of course, it all blows up. But at the same time, Washington's men are also saying, this isn't worth it. I mean, and this is what we don't get out of history. We get the story of Valley Forge, where everybody came out of it all determined, worse, even fight harder. But that, in actual fact, the army suffered from high desertion. A lot of the men were like had enough. They're all living in these, they called it a log city. They built 1,000 little log cabins for the winter in Morristown. Well, these became little hells. they're all starving. They're these smoky, dark cabins. There's like eight men to a cabin, and they, you know, were dying in there, and there's all this sickness. And so, you know, this was a very hellish time for the American Army that really far outstripped what they went through in Valley Forge.
We're going to talk about what kind of strategy was deployed unsuccessfully in the attempt to capture Washington right there in Morristown. We're visiting with William Hazelgrove about his latest book. It's titled Morristown, The Darkest Winter of the Revolutionary War and the Plot to Kidnap George Washington. I don't know that there's an answer to this next question, but you were talking about Benedict Arnold and side bets on the success or the failure of the American cause and the idea that people were thinking, what do I do? Where do I side? I still have to think about the common foot soldier who might not be making a side bet on the outcome. That's just a poor, suffering soul who doesn't have any food in his swill.
Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing because, you know, I used a lot of diaries that were left behind. And they talked about eating leather, you know, eating tree bark, not having food for days, if not weeks, never being paid, freezing. So the question is, why would you stay with this? You know, why would they stop? And here it gets worse. There's a thing called the London Market at this time. All right, so farmers around Morristown had good crops, so they had a lot of grain and food and all sorts of things. But they weren't giving it to Washington. Why? Because American scrip was worth nothing. Inflation had made American money almost valueless. So the British had what's called the London Market, and they paid gold. So they sold it to the British. The troops knew this. They knew that there was food around Morristown, but they weren't getting it. Because the farmer said, you know what? I can't survive with this worthless money. I need gold, and so they were selling to the British. So this was very unpatriotic. In fact, it was really hurting the American cause. So all these things combined, and the question is really not, oh, they should have stayed in, but why didn't they all mutiny? I mean, when they did mutiny, it was a sort of a, think of it this way, they started marching around the camp without obeying orders, and basically they were talking about marching right out of Morristown, just leaving. And finally, it was sort of put down. But this was because they literally had nothing to lose at this point. And Washington had to confront them and had to tell them what they were fighting for, the cause, the honorable cause. And really, in the end of the day, it was patriotism that kept them in Morristown and kept the army together. It was the cause, this American Revolution, this cause for the unborn millions. You know, and this is something that was a phrase that was used by Henry Knox and Washington. This is not for us. This is for the unborn millions that are to come. So these gaunt, starving, scarecrow men hung in there against all odds, you know, without the support of a lot of the country. And so it would have been an amazing thing. If anything, it's a testament to Washington and his hold on them and also his sort of spiritual leadership in this honorable cause, as he called it. And so the British were right in one thing, that if they got rid of Washington, then the revolution would definitely fall apart.
Well, let's get back to this General John Simcoe and his Queen's Rangers, and they've crossed the Hudson on solid ice this terrible winter. And as I understand it from your account, there are attempts to, hoodwink the American soldiers and put forces in different directions, and these are decoys.
Yeah, exactly. So what happened was, as does a lot of times, Simcoe comes up with this great plan, presents it to his superiors, and they're like, hey, that's a great plan, but we're going to take it over and take credit for it. So they tell Simcoe, well, you aren't going to be the force to get Washington. You're going to create a diversion. We're going to use German mercenaries to do this. And these German mercenaries were just, you know, brutal. They're the ones that would, you know, pin Americans to the trees with their sabers, and they were promised that they could loot and pillage all they wanted in America. And so they're using these guys, and their caps have, death or glory on them. So they're the ones that are actually going to go get Washington. So Simcoe becomes a diversionary sort of force, where he's supposed to go up, make everybody think that they're the force coming to get Washington. And in fact, there was a lot of spies around, and Washington actually was informed. One of the first chapters I open up, he's getting a letter saying, Your Excellency, we know there's a plot to kidnap you afoot. And he just says, no, I've got what's called the lifeguard. Now, the lifeguard was his secret service. It was composed of a whole troop of men who were with him all the time, and all around the Ford Mansion. Now, the Ford Mansion, again, it was probably 3 to 5 miles away from the main force, and the British knew this. But he's like, no, the lifeguard will hold me in good stead. So they launch the big expedition. Again, Simcoe is his big diversionary part of the expedition. The main force, the mercenaries, are headed straight for Washington, and they even had a plan where they would tie up their horses in a nearby swamp, put on moccasins, and creep into the Washington mansion. They knew Washington was on the second floor, asleep with Martha. Martha had come up to stay with him, and they knew that where the lifeguards were, and their thought was they would go slit the throat of the lifeguard, go in with great stealth with these moccasins, grab him, put him on a horse, and take him back.
And did they get within 100 yards?
Right. So what happens to this? Well, we talked about the weather. All right, so everything goes to plan. The diversionary force with Simcoe, he basically goes bolting across the Hudson, raises all sorts of hell, and he literally gets chased back, and that's what he wants. The Americans all start chasing him all the way down to the Hudson, and he crosses back to the Hudson, and he lets the British generals know, okay, I've done it, I've had my force. Well, meanwhile, the main force of all the mercenaries are running for Washington, and the weather seems it's okay in the beginning, but then it starts to drop. The temperature starts to drop. Then this sort of weird wet snow falls, and what happens? Well, this hard crust on the surface of the snow forms, and this thing called forelocks. Horses have forelocks, and that is where the joint bends right before the hoof. Okay, so as this, super revved up, the mercenary force of Germans are going to get Washington, and they get within miles of his mansion where he's sleeping, this frozen snow starts to cut all the forelocks of the horses. So all this blood starts to just gush from their forelocks, and they stop and realize they can't go any further. This weather, this once-in-a-century weather that allowed them to cross, is now stopping them from getting all the way to Morristown, getting to the Ford Mansion, and grabbing Washington. And so they had a signal where they would shoot rockets off if they were going to abort. They fire off the rockets, turn around, within miles of getting Washington, and have to head back across the Hudson before they're discovered.
Now, during the same time period of this horrible weather of the winter and then that storm, that particular storm, all the while there are people in Congress who are thinking, can't be that bad.
Right, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. So basically what's going on is Washington's writing Congress and saying, look, I can't pay anybody, we don't have any food, we're coming apart. We aren't going to have an army unless you do something. I need money, I need food, we need horses, we need other things. And Washington's like, oh, this guy's just a complainer. Congress is like, he's always complaining. So they're like, you know what? Maybe we can't use this guy. So, this is kind of hard for us to believe that they're sort of thinking Washington might just not be the guy. And so they send a commission down there to investigate, right, to go to Morristown, basically to sort of tell Washington, shut up, you're fine. If not, we'll get somebody else. They go down there, and what they find is they're astounded. The army's starving. There's all sorts of desertion. They're appalled at the conditions they're living in. And they send back to Congress and say, oh, no, you've got to do something or this whole thing's going to fall apart right now. I mean, Washington wrote this. He said, this will not stand. This army will not stand. It's falling apart before our eyes. In the revolution, we're going to lose the war. And so they stayed there. They didn't even leave. They said, we're going to stay here, and we need everything. We need money. We need food. We need whatever you can give us. And so, that sort of sent out the alarm that, in fact, the Continental Army was falling apart.
So what's to keep the British from sitting back and waiting for better weather?
Well, actually, they did. They after this failed attempt, they started to, think, all right, well, we'll just try it again. Well, the weather just went horrible again. All right, they had, snowstorm after snowstorm after snowstorm. And not only did this imprison Washington and his army, but it also kept people from trying to come up there. And so Simcoe and others were thinking, well, we can take another run at this. Well, then what happened was the weather turned on a dime again, and the Hudson started to soften up. So that opportunity to dart across the Hudson was lost. This once-in-a-century freezing was lost. And you know the whole plot to kidnap Washington hinged on the fact that they could shoot across, get him, and shoot back across the Hudson during the winter.
Yeah. It seems like they put a lot of eggs in that basket.
Well, they did. And then you know there was eventually, when the weather did warm up, there was the Battle of Morristown, where actually the British then just went after Washington's whole force, and Washington's force fought them off. They tried to cross several rivers, were actually turned into shooting galleries. Washington's men were very good shots, and really a very small force held off a very large force of the British. And the Battle of Morristown that I end the book with is actually a very, very significant battle. And at the same time, Benedict Arnold's plot is revealed, where he was going to give up forts all up and down the Hudson and take this money, and he was giving all this information to the British about what Washington's plans were, because Washington was still meeting with him, thinking he was just this great general. And that was revealed at the same time, this incredible treason. And, of course, as you know in the book, one of the final moments is Washington tries to get revenge. He knows that Benedict Arnold's in New York, and he sends an expedition, a very small group of men, to try and kidnap him and bring him to justice. But actually, Arnold manages to slip away to Britain with his wife, or to England, rather, with his wife.
Yeah. So let's tie a bow or a yellow ribbon or something. Let's tie something now here to kind of encapsulate this whole episode in terms of, you say it's more important than Valley Forge. More difficult than Valley Forge. I don't know. Did you say important or more difficult then?
I would say more difficult.
Yeah. And is this one of those turning points, or is this a story of a fluke of something that didn't happen?
It is actually a turning point, because at this point, the British were trying for a knockout punch. You know, I begin the book saying, like two punch-drunk fighters, the British and the Americans were in the 10th round. And this is true. The British wanted this war to end, and they saw this as an opportunity to do it. And Washington, simultaneously, his force was falling apart with incredible doubt. And at the same time, you had Benedict Arnold, the plot to kidnap Washington, all these things coming to sort of fruition at the same time, sort of a perfect storm of just bad things that were happening to the American Revolution in 1779. And at the end of it, they held Morristown. The British could not get Washington. Benedict Arnold went on the run. And the French finally started to make a difference. Up till now, the French were like very flighty. They're like, oh, yeah, we're going to support you. And they did nothing. In fact, they were supposed to support Washington, and they took all their ships down south to ride out the winter, this horrible winter. And so they finally came back after this, Lafayette and others, and said, we are here for you. And so it's sort of like this was a moment where everything looked darkest before the dawn, and it was the moment where the British saw an opportunity to knock the Americans out of the war. And, you know, if Benedict Arnold had been able to give up the fort at West Point and had succeeded in his plan even, that would have been a big turning point in the war. The British had a lot of irons in the fire. Obviously, getting Washington would have been a huge one, but even if they would have been able to just chase his army out of Morristown, because they thought his army was weak enough for them to just sort of beat them once and for all, that would have been it too. So, you know, all these things sort of were coming together, and the Americans lived to fight another day. And, of course, you know, which would eventually lead to Yorktown, where finally the British said, we've had enough. This is over for us, you know. Whatever this is, we're done.
It was just a race to see who could be the least demoralized the soonest.
Absolutely. It was really an endurance fight. I mean, it was, who's going to stay in on this? The British knew the Americans had had enough. The Americans were hoping that the British could not just knock them out and they could live to fight another day, because all they had to really do was survive. Because the British, again, it was an economic debacle for them. They were having to use all these mercenaries because America was so big. So politically, it was becoming very unpopular in Britain. Their whole thing was, we need to survive to fight another day. And that's why the British were really right on by trying to trap Washington and kidnap him, because that would have stopped them. That would have stopped this whole insurgent movement to say, you know, well, let's run here, run there, shoot at them from the sides. You know, the Americans were great shots, and they would, you know, fire from, you know, the woods, stone walls, and then melt back into the forest. And this drove the British crazy.
So weather generally, truly can be a major player, a major contender. And I want to go back. We haven't said it yet, but you say in your book that nobody in their lifetime had any memory of a winter this severe.
No. In fact, Washington said in the beginning that, you know, the oldest inhabitants of the county never remembered anything like this. So, you know, this just in one of the opening chapters is General Simcoe out on the Hudson, you know, getting ready to cross it to go on the mission to get Washington, and he's just marveling at how, you know, this frozen expanse he'd never seen before, you know, under this blue moon. And, you know, it was just one of those, you know, super, super cold winters that just changed everything. But again, it made it hell for Washington's men. You know, and by the way, Washington was in the Ford Mansion, but the Ford Mansion was very cold. They, you know, these fireplaces were inefficient. His ink would freeze in his quill. I mean, this, you know, this was not, you know, as we turn on the central air or central heat and you're fine. Usually the kitchen was the warmest place in any of these dwellings. And actually Washington was sort of crowded into it because Mr. Ford had died, but Mrs. Ford was still there with her family, and they always hung in the kitchen. So Washington hated going to the kitchen. So, you know, he was sort of grumpy about that. There was a lot of discontent personally and, you know, within the fighting force of the Continental Army. And again, the country was weary. It was tired of this thing, this whole dragged-on, you know, revolution that was supposed to have ended. And the British were still there, and the Americans were still there, but nobody could really get the upper hand. So, again, I go back to my first sort of metaphor, which is two punch-drunk fighters in the 10th round.
You know, in my own family history, going back to Mormon pioneer days, there's an exodus happening out of Illinois, and the freezing of the Mississippi is the way that those first pioneers are able to make their getaway, you know, and cross the frozen river. And they saw that as providential, albeit very, very cold providence, you know. I'm wondering if amongst those British expeditioners there wasn't somebody thinking, ah, this is better than opportune. This is providential. Do you suppose that could have happened?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we don't regard rivers the way people did then, because there was one of the few ways to get goods down through the country, to move troops up and down. So if you, the Hudson bisected the country. So if you take control of the Hudson, You would have the American fighting force. You would have the American colonies. This is why what Benedict Arnold was doing was so important, that he wanted to give up West Point, the fort at West Point, to the British, because they could control it then. And so that was very important. So I think it was, a lot of people did view it as providence, that suddenly this river that never froze. And that they could cross it. And, you know, I think, I'm sure for the British, they saw God was saying to them, here's your moment. Here's your opportunity to get this pestilence that has sort of dogged you all these years, and you can end this war once and for all, and that will be it. And, you know, there's a lot of people in politics in Britain who wanted out of America.
So you've written the book about what didn't happen.
Yes. That's exactly right.
And you did it very well. Hey, William Hazelgrove, a pleasure to hear the details from you. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
William Hazelgrove's latest book, titled Morristown, The Darkest Winter of the Revolutionary War and the Plot to Kidnap George Washington.
We're going to lighten things up with another George Washington story, but this time from a more quirky angle. Among other questions, we'll consider this. Why were so many Washington biographers preoccupied with the first president's thighs? Next on Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. More now on George Washington. Biographer Alexis Coe tackles Washington's conflicted attitude towards slavery. And she reminds us that Washington was raised by a single mother. She also notes that he once fought for the British. In fact, if he'd been more satisfied with his appointment there, we may not have had an American Revolution. But Alexis Coe also makes some amusing analysis. She's the author of You Never Forget Your First, A Biography of George Washington. We start here with the oddity that so many Washington biographers were preoccupied with his thighs.
One of the hallmarks of Washington biographers, these hundreds of men, was that they're really into his body. And they're really just into his build. You know, they talk about him the way we shouldn't discuss other people, but sometimes do. And in particular, they love his thighs. And not just like how they look.
Just a moment. You got to be kidding me. They focus on what do we call them?
Yeah.
The quads. We're looking at his quads and the hamstrings and such.
Yeah, they look at the thighs in particular, and they can't help but notice that they're quite muscular, and they like what he does with them. You know, how he grips a horse, and but it really starts with the thighs, and I have to tell you that I did sort of think, am I missing something? Am I just, he's not my type? You know, I looked at Hamilton and I looked at Madison, I looked at all these portraits to see, were his legs so incredibly better than the rest of them? And I have to tell you, Hamilton had really nice legs. He really did.
Well, you know, no matter who you're sizing up here, you're relying on the painter's interpretation. This is not
Absolutely.
Photographic evidence.
No, and of course the subject is sitting there, you know, looking and commenting, and Washington in particular hated sitting for portraits. But it starts with the thighs, which is why I just sort of started calling them the thigh men of dad history, because dad history is, you know, presidential history is traditionally thought of as, you know, something dads read or you buy your dad for Father's Day. And that's not a bad thing. It just isn't diverse. And I think that we've certainly learned in the last few years, if not, you know, I would like to think for a long time, that the presidency has, you know, interested a lot of different people, women, people of color, younger men. And we need books that speak to that, too. They're not all these, like, you know, 1,000-page tomes. So I had it sort of in parentheses for a long time, and all my second readers and my editor kept capitalizing it and taking it out of parentheses. And then fast forward, it is like all over the news, and Washington's presidential library is using it as a hashtag. I did not anticipate that.
Well, I'm just imagining you sit for a portrait. And most people would say, could you, you know, elevate my cheekbones just a little here? But Washington's
right.
Sitting there saying, can you work on those thighs of mine for it's just.
Well, I think he was more concerned with in that era, foreheads were considered regal. You really, the chin didn't matter. You could have a small chin and that was fine. A weak chin, as it would later be called, but you needed to have a really high forehead that was dignified.
Yeah, and this is before phrenology, when people are feeling the head to see if you're intelligent and that kind of stuff. As long as we're dealing with physiology and you're on the face there, we ought to just go straight to the teeth now. Shall we do that?
Let's do it.
Talk to us about George Washington's ostensibly wooden teeth.
Right. And so it's interesting, because if you ask people what they know about Jefferson or, you know, Hamilton, of course, because of the musical, you get a variety of things. But if you ask, you know, your average person what they know about Washington, one of the things they're going to say, the first thing they'll say is probably couldn't tell a lie. And then the next thing they say is wooden teeth. And nobody has any idea where this came from. I personally think it is connected to the cherry tree story. But I think it's interesting because it suggests this fundamental problem that we don't engage with Washington either which way. He's kind of always in the background. And so we say, ah, ha, 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 wooden teeth. And we know that's not true. It couldn't be true. If you got them wet, it would be awful. His breath would have been terrible. But he clearly had something going on. And that's true. His teeth were awful. And he did. He only had one when he was inaugurated left. He kept a bunch in his desk drawer, but they weren't usable for the same reason they failed the first time around. He probably had not great teeth genetically, and of course dentistry was barbaric, but his dentures were at best, a poacher's smile. He had ivory from hippos and walruses, and the rest of them were human teeth, and they were from enslaved people, which was not uncommon with well-to-do people in the 18th century in America and abroad.
Are you talking about are they cadavers of enslaved people?
No, these are teeth that it's possible fell out as his did, but also enslaved people in order to make any money, because they were often underfed and underclothed. And this isn't, just for Washington. This is sort of across the board with slavery. They would sell him their teeth under market value. And so I think often they would, in fact, pull their teeth in order to have something to sell him.
This is, I don't know what to do with this.
Well, we know this. I should follow up and say that this isn't a theory. We know this because Washington kept ledgers in his own hand of things that he purchased from, either if it was from London finery or if it was from the enslaved people. And, so we know exactly how much he paid and when, and it's a lot. It's a lot to sit with.
Yeah. Well, this opens the door now to talking about Washington and his slaves. And I take it, let me preface it with this. I'm going to quote you something that you said for an interview with a Smithsonian. Mm-hmm. And so I hope the editors did their job and these are actually your words. I think they are. I don't feel a need to protect Washington. He doesn't need me to come to his defense. And I don't think he needed his past biographers to either. But they're so worried about him. I'm not worried about him. He's everywhere. He's just fine.
Yeah.
So what is the protection there about protecting his reputation, keeping the heroic figure intact and all of that?
Yeah. So I think that what's interesting is because Washington is not as popular as Jefferson or other people who we have seen face challenges to their legacy in, I would say, particularly the last few years, but for some time now, certainly since Annette Gordon Reed made the connection between Jefferson and Hemings, Sally Hemings. I think that Washington scholars have sort of enjoyed that they can protect him a little bit. You get military buffs and you get, these dad history readers, but you don't really get people outside of it. And they are really afraid that if we start talking honestly about Washington's slavery without sort of always trying to make the punchline or the end note, positive, that he will, to use the parlance of our time, be canceled. And I don't think that's true. I think it is impossible to cancel Washington. And I don't think that we should automatically panic. I assume that my reader and that all Americans are smart and mature and able to handle different things at once. And they can understand, just like a family member or anyone else that they know, that some people who have who can be really great in some ways are really terrible in others. And that's what I mean. We can just talk about this honestly without saying, we've got to get rid of George Washington, take him out of our textbooks, replace him on the dollar. He is fundamental to our founding. And the more we look at him really closely and honestly, the better we'll understand ourselves.
Yeah, and for all of what you say, which I'm in agreement with, it still seems like a bitter pill to swallow that he was, I guess, was it Lafayette or somebody gave him an opportunity to say, or at least a hint, a suggestion, you could set your slaves free, and he never did.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, right? Because we want these people to to do the what we consider the right thing, right? And what, which obviously the Marquis de Lafayette also thought was the right thing. And people like Ben Franklin decided this was the right thing over time. He started out as a slave owner, and of course he's now known as a famous abolitionist. And that was, and Washington was born in Virginia. He inherited slaves when he was 11 years old and acquired through marriage and through purchase hundreds of slaves throughout his life. And that's just a reality. We wish something different, surely, but there's a difference between someone who is historically significant, which Washington is, and someone who is a role model. If you want to make a personal choice, make Washington your role model, by all means. But fundamentally, he is historically significant, so we can't project these things. And what we do know is he struggled with this, both the optics of slavery and the practice, but not not in the way that we wish he had. You know, he struggled with it because he knew it wasn't a great look after he fought in the Revolution and he was exposed to people, Europeans like Lafayette, who were doing away with slavery. He began to think, okay, I've got to get rid of this. He thought the state should do something about it, but he thought it should be such a gradual process. These are his words, that it should be imperceptible, meaning that, you know, you don't actually see, you know, manumission.
So we're talking about all gain and no pain.
Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of also passing the buck, which he sort of did eventually too. But so Lafayette writes to him, he spends decades writing to him, and he says, you know, how about this plan? Or like, I'll buy land with you and you don't have to sell or free your slaves, because that was a complicated process. You can just, you know, give them this land and we'll try out like a tenant farmer situation, which of course we know would later be like sharecropping. And so he had all these ideas, and Washington wrote right back, I'm thinking about this. You are such a sweet man. Let's talk in 3 years when you visit. Mm-hmm. And that sort of just kept happening. And he had two wills when he died. One, a lawyer had put together for him, you know, years before, and one that he wrote himself in June, and he died in December. And the one that he told Martha to burn was the earlier one. And the one that he had her keep, which I'm not sure she actually knew was different or how it was different than the other one, had a complicated scheme. And because they were married, but Martha was married before and she had brought enslaved people to the marriage, those people were off limits, but they did have shared slaves and his slaves. And what he said was, one man, Billy Lee, William Lee, will be freed outright upon my death, meaning Washington dies, Billy Lee gets his freedom, he gets an annuity, he gets all these things. But the rest of them, my slaves, will be freed either upon Martha's death, which could have been, you know, 10, 15 years into the future, or at her will. Now, Martha, we know from the things that she wrote in letters, we don't have to go into it, she did not believe that Black people should be free. And it is unlikely that she was going to do that. But the option was, in the end, very good for her because, as we know from letters from Abigail Adams and from others to Bushrod Washington, her nephew, who was a Supreme Court justice, who we all forget, that she feared for her life. Because Washington's will was published. This was something I think he really did want to do. He just didn't know how to do it. You know, and he didn't want it to happen during his lifetime because he benefited from the enslaved people, which is why he also wanted them to be enslaved by Martha so she could benefit from their labor. But he did really want this, but and he wanted people to know he had done this because it was good for his legacy. He was otherwise considered, you know, kind of the greatest man in the world. And so he had the will published, and those who could read of his enslaved population did, and they very much knew what was happening. A few ran away boldly, and the rest, according to Martha, threatened to kill her in different ways, burn down her house, murder her in the middle of the night, goes on, and so she did. But, you know, they had married into her slave family. So it is, in the end, these families were separated and never saw each other again. Husbands, wives, children, parents, It's either way you cut it, it's devastating.
And this has been a somewhat circuitous conversation, and we're not adhering to any chronology. So maybe we could go back now to George Washington's childhood, where he came from. If you're going to have a hero, you got to have the story of, well, you know, what happened in childhood that launched that career.
It's strange to me that we don't talk about Washington the way we talk about Obama, Clinton, Ford, Andrew Jackson, and even Thomas Jefferson, being that all of these men were raised by single women and single mothers. And the reason that's important is it really informs who they are, right? Because especially in early America, if you are raised by a woman who doesn't have the same rights or access or gets the same respect if she's trying to sell something, you're going to struggle. And so to me, that's a really formative experience. But it's interesting, I've gotten a lot of feedback where people just, it goes back to your original question, you know, why are people defensive about Washington, why his biographers are? And I guess this relates to it, that people don't think that Washington should even be mentioned in the same sentence as Obama or someone they don't agree with. But Washington went without. He was the oldest child from the second marriage. So in addition to being raised by a mother who was in charge of this farm, they didn't get a lot. The good stuff all was left to the two sons from the first marriage who were grown. And so there were times where Washington couldn't afford to feed his horse. He certainly couldn't afford to stay in school, which he would be very self-conscious of later in life when he was with Jefferson and Adams, you know, who went to respectively College of William & Mary and Harvard. And he had to work. And so there were different schemes that were introduced, but eventually he became a surveyor, which was the best job for him because he loved math, he loved the outdoors, and he had this like tough constitution. And then ironically, he fought for the British.
Yeah, we don't tell that part, do we?
No, we gloss over that. And it's interesting, the British are kind of, this isn't published in the UK, the book You Never Forget Your First, and yet I've had so much press over there because they're obsessed with him. And I think that's a little bit funny too, because I mean, it's sort of like being obsessed with someone who broke up with you, you know. He led the rebellion. Had they just given him the promotion he wanted as head of the Virginia militia as a young man in his 20s, I don't know. I think we might be British subjects today.
Alexis Coe is the author of You Never Forget Your First, a biography of George Washington. You know, on Constant Wonder, we often highlight how some animals are very smart, even downright brilliant, and emotionally complex as well. Tomorrow on Constant Wonder, a science writer and master storyteller introduces us to the inner worlds of ants, crows, and feral dogs, among other surprising species. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.